morality. When I was a boy, I grew up in the Netherlands Methodist Church, and we were taught two things in the Sunday school, I seem to remember. One was that to avoid drinking alcohol if possible, and secondly, not to gamble. I realise now that both these things can be addictive, but there are many other addictions. While I have a little confession, while I have never gambled, I even once refused as a boy to take part in some fundraising thing where you had to guess the number of beads in a jar. And I looked at the jar and I thought, that's really a matter of chance. That's equivalent to gambling. But there was a prize, of course. But I, but let me confess that I now break my early prohibition on alcohol, in as much as late at night, when I'm sure that I won't be called on to drive anywhere, I have one can of medium strength beer. I've got an arrow to go over the page. I hadn't drunk any alcohol at all until I married at 28, and and when I proposed marriage, I said to my wife, would she agree that we would be as my parents were? It wasn't that they refused absolutely to drink alcohol if they were out at a dinner or something, there were toasts with alcohol supplied, but that we would not normally keep alcohol in the house. That meant it could be brought in for some special occasion, even for making Christmas cakes, but maybe on some occasion. And she agreed to that. But then, and that went on for 4 years, that we didn't have any alcohol in the house. And when the second baby arrived, I have four children, she said, could she buy a bottle of sherry, because her mother would come with a friend in the afternoon, and she was used to having a glass of sherry, you know, with her afternoon tea, as it were. And I've later thought maybe I should have said, can't she bring her own? But I didn't, of course. I said, oh, yes, of course. And then I noticed that even when grandmother, my mother-in-law, was not visiting, the level in the bottle would go down and the bottle would be replaced, but it wasn't affecting my wife's behaviour, so I wasn't worried. But we got to the stage when on one or two occasions my wife said, oh, I don't want this meal, and she and went off to bed. She didn't want to drink the meal. And I said to my daughter, Tracy, who was probably about 12 or so at this stage, that looks like the behaviour of an alcoholic, and yet she's only had one glass of wine with her meal. And my daughter said, ah, Dad, you haven't you don't observe what she's drinking while she's cooking the meal. And things got, drink affects people in different ways. It affected my wife by becoming argumentative, and eventually I thought, this is not good for these children, between 12 and 18 approximately, four children that age. Because she would always pick a fight with one of the children, I would defend the child and then the argument would be with me, and then she would get all upset and march off to bed without having eaten her meal. And so I thought, to solve the domestic arguments, which was bad for the children, I thought, I'd better separate. And I took the boys and left the girls, thinking the girls, if she was alone, she would probably drink herself to death quite quickly. But with two daughters to look after, that would be a moderating effect. Well, as the children reached 18, of course, they all left home, either to work or, one case, to marry, except for the younger son, who stayed with me till second year university. So that's the... Oh, I've got a little note here that when I noticed that my wife was drinking and that she was making friends among people who drank, she played tennis, and the friends she had were always the ones who invited her home for some drink. I thought, do I stay strictly teetotal, or do I join her in some way without indulging too much? And so there was a bottle of lemonade in the refrigerator. That was Daddy's lemonade. That was what I put in to dilute the wine down. But I don't know whether that was a good strategy or not, but I did it. Covered all that. The effect of this is that both my sons are completely teetotal, and my daughters are pretty restrained in their drinking. The effect of having an alcoholic mother has had that effect. Seems to have got a bit out of order. I was going to define nonconformist. I take that to mean people who are not Roman Catholic, and they're not Anglican. And it seems to be that very largely that these people a nonconformist because there was a time when there was only one church, and if the monarch was Anglican, as Henry VIII became, then the church was Church of England. When we had Queen Mary, she reverted to Catholicism, and burnt those who wouldn't change. There were a lot of burning of people who, if they differed from you, they were heretics. So the nonconformists were people who wouldn't conform to whatever was the state religion. And they grew rapidly during the Civil War. You remember when the Parliament fought the King, and the Parliament won, but during that period there was a lot of civil unrest. There were no authorities in many places to enforce anything at all, and it seems to be that non-conformity spread quite a lot. You have people like John Bunyan, who is thought to have fought briefly. He may have been a chaplain in the parliamentary army, who then started to preach and got imprisoned for it. And while he's in prison, I was always touched by the fact that what worried him, he didn't mind going to prison, but he had a blind daughter. He would worry about the welfare of his blind daughter. John Bunyan's dates are 1628 to 1688. I looked that up because another preacher who about that time during the Civil War was George Fox, and his dates, he was born 4 years earlier and in 1624, but he lived till 91. He also spent a lot of time in prison for preaching his doctrines, which, having observed the corruption of the clergy of the day, because becoming a clergyman was a sort of sinecure, you had a good income and you could do a lot of fox hunting and such things, but he preached that, like the early Christians, you didn't need an ordained clergy. You could worship God in groups. In fact, if you didn't have an ordained clergyman or a preacher for the day, you might wait quietly on the Lord and see if anyone felt led to say something, felt they had a message for the congregation from God. And so Quaker worship was sometimes called silent worship, but in fact it's much better described as unprogrammed worship, because would be unlikely to be completely silent. But the convention is, having belonged to the society, I can speak with some authority, the convention is that if someone speaks, the next person who has something to say waits till the message has, people have considered that message. There's not a... there's always a silence after someone speaks. Well, the Puritans, of course, were nonconformists who fled persecution and went first to the Netherlands, and then some of them later went across to America. The Pilgrim Fathers, as they were called. You'll probably get out early because one of the readings has already been given. But the other reading I had was I think this is relevant to the topic of it's from 1 Corinthians chapter 3 verse 16-17. Do you not know that you are God's temple and that God's Spirit dwells in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him, for God's temple is holy, and that temple you are. And I suspect that verse is the origin of the nonconformist prohibition on alcohol, in that when people start to drink alcohol, they do not know if they will become addicted or not. And so the nonconformist prohibition was to protect people. I'm not sure if I've covered all the things that I meant to cover, but I certainly when I spoke before, I ended this way, and I thought I'd do so again. I once spoke here about Albert Schweitzer, the young man who taught theology, and he taught philosophy, and he had doctorates in those subjects, and then he also went to Paris and studied with him and got a doctorate in music. And did a lot of playing of the organ. He was an organist, and he decided that he was having a really good time teaching at the university, and perhaps he should spend. He decided that when he got to 30, he would spend the rest of his life in the service of mankind. So at about that time, he went and got his fourth doctorate in medicine. And he had to write a thesis for this doctorate in medicine. And he wrote a psychiatric study of Jesus. Was he paranoid? Using the information from the Gospels for that study. I've often thought if someone had translated into English, it might be interesting to read. I mean, he obviously concluded that he was not, but it was a thesis submitted to the university for a doctorate, so presumably it was academically sound. Anyhow, he went off to Africa after this training as a doctor, and he went to Gabon, I think, French Equatorial Africa it might have been called, where he set up some sort of a hospital. I think during the First World War, he came from Alsace, Alsace, which is on the border between Germany and France. And depending on who won the last war, it becomes part of one nation or the other. But after a conflict in 1890 or thereabouts, it had become part of Germany. And so when the First World War came along, the French authorities declared he was German and shipped him off to a prison in France somewhere, and he had to wait till the war was over to come back to resume. This time he raised a lot of money playing his organ around the place, he moved to, he got a new site and built a new hospital. Apparently, a lot with his own hands, or at least supervising people. You know, he got his hands dirty building this thing. And his wife got some tropical disease or couldn't stand the climate. And she and her daughter went home, and he worked on alone. And apart from maybe a few trips to raise money by playing the organ, he stayed there for the rest of his life. And at night he would write by lantern light. Now, I haven't written down the details of the books that he wrote, but he did write. There was one about his missionary work, I think, called Out of My Life and Time, something like that. But he also wrote virtually his interpretation, I guess, of the gospel message. And I'm going to just end by quoting from one of the books he wrote, which was called, well, this is the English translation. I think the German might have been something like a sketch of the life of Jesus, but I might be confusing another different book. Sorry, he wrote several books, but I'm going to quote from a book called The Quest of the Historical Jesus. And Albert Schweitzer wrote this, which I quoted once before many years ago. He comes to us as one unknown, without a name, as of old, by the lakeside. He came to those who knew him not. He speaks to us the same word. Follow thou me. And sets us to the tasks which he has to fulfill for our time. He commands, and to those who obey him, whether they be wise or simple, he will reveal himself in the toils, the conflicts, the sufferings which they shall pass through in his fellowship, and as an ineffable mystery, they shall learn in their own experience who he is.